Okay. Right, so welcome everyone to week two. The reason I'm here is that in addition to this week being the launch of the International Year of Astronomy, some of you might have heard about the conference taking place over the weekend and all through this week, I was also invited to go to a conference in India on Friday. So I'm still intending to do that. The trouble is, I applied for my Indian visa on the 4th of January and up until Friday afternoon had not yet received either my visa or, more importantly, my passport. So unfortunately that meant that, well, you don't need a visa to go to France. As far as I know, you need a passport. And therefore I had to quite radically change my plans. Notwithstanding that, it's a pleasure to be here. Because the other reason is, well, there's really two main reasons. One is that I didn't get through quite as much of the introductory material as I'd hoped. So it's kind of sensible to cover all that first, tell you about how Hubble was designed, what went wrong, how we fixed it, what's on Hubble now. And then from next week, we'll start off with Alec reviewing what Hubble's told us about the solar system, and then I'll come back and talk about stars and galaxies and so on. The other big advantage is that I only get back from India at 7 o'clock next Monday morning, so I may have been a bit spaced out next Monday night anyway. So this way you get me a bit more coherent tonight, perhaps. You see, that's life. I regret not having begun the process to get my visa earlier. But in the visa office, the poster does say, you know, will be returned within 1 to 2 working days. And sadly, that was not how things worked out. But anyway, not to worry. Actually, quite a lot of the conference that I was supposed to be attending, I think, is being streamed on the internet. And it's on the cultural impact of astronomy. So it's not, you know, too high-powered a conference. It's actually, in many ways, equally appropriate for, you know, a day's audience. So what I'll do is I'll post a link to their website on the Hubble Vision website, so that if there's any of the talks later this week that you want to have a look at and download, then feel free to do so. I was supposed to be chairing a session this morning, for example, on astronomy and music, and it was looking at ways in which either astronomers have been musical or indeed musicians have used astronomy as a way to either popularise their music or just, you know, generally get good publicity. So it's quite an interesting conference, but I'm afraid I'll have to manage without me. So what I want to do today is to round off the story of, you know, the kind of a brief history of the telescope, if you like, talking about the kinds of telescopes that we have here on the ground and the reasons why having a space telescope was a very powerful one. Just a quick recap of the course aim. So this is very much in the process of just laying the groundwork so that we can then go on for the remaining 8 weeks to concentrate on this main topic, the scientific legacy of HST. So we're still very much, just as I say, in this first one, a brief history of telescopes and the case for space, and then we'll get cracking with Alec McKinnon next week on HST and the solar system. Now, my very sudden change of plans, because I wasn't able to get my visa on Friday afternoon, I was due to leave for Paris on Sunday, means that I'd already, in a very organised way, given Alec McKinnon the register for this week. Of course, it's not his fault, and it all went wrong, so I wasn't able to get that from him today, I'm afraid. So what I'm going to do, if you don't mind, I'll just circulate a sheet of paper, and if you can just write your name to see you're here, and then I'll get that transferred. I know it's probably not really that important that DACE has records of these things, but it all helps to maintain a strong case for us running courses like this one, if we can say that they're well attended. So if you don't mind doing that, Robert,
yeah,
just let you start. Okay, and pass it round. So next week Alec will have the register, and then I'll be back after that, and I'll be around for most of February. I think pretty much all of February I'm here, but we've got another few guest speakers lined up, and details on those to follow. Okay, so before we press on with our sort of review of the wonderful world of telescopes, both ground and space-based, does anyone get any questions they'd like to ask to start us off?
You know the telescope's getting another revamp.
Yeah.
Is this because there's a gap between what we have and what we will have in 4 or 5 years after that?
It's an interesting question. Can I defer that one? Because I've devoted quite a lot of tonight to looking at the 3 servicing missions so far, and also the 4th servicing mission, and all the, you know, it's a very good question actually. Just to, you know, give you a kind of preview of my answer, I think it's in a way as much to do with PR as anything else. You know, I think a lot of good science will come out of what they're going to put on board in the fourth servicing mission, but it was never really part of NASA's plans to do it that way. And I think it's just because there's been such a public outcry, oh, you can't switch off the Hubble telescope, you know, which is very gratifying, frankly, but it's almost created the need for, you know, getting some good science out of the fourth mission. But I say, well, we'll see that a wee bit later on. That's a good point. Okay, so let's see where we can get to tonight. I say I'll do my utmost to get through this section without rushing too much. But still quite a lot of ground to cover, because we'd essentially got ourselves to the point where telescopes had started to get very big. Around about the middle of the 20th century is when the 5-metre Palomar telescope, the Palomar Observatory 200-inch telescope was built. And all the material from last week, up to and including those last few slides, is already on the web. So just a wee reminder that that's the web address and the username and password where you can find things. I've put them on as a PDF file. There's also MP3 files of the commentary of me talking, and they're quite big, but I'll continue to put them on as the semester rolls on. Okay, so as I said, I should be in Paris, but I'm not, but nonetheless, it's a pleasure to be here, and all the more so because with it being the launch of International Year of Astronomy just a few days ago, you might have heard the reports about Mr. Harriot, who made maps of the moon before Galileo did. So already I'm feeling a little sheepish that perhaps I should have given more credit to him last week. I think it's still fair to say that A, Galileo's maps were more detailed, and more importantly perhaps, Galileo's use of the telescope led on to a number of important sort of scientific revolutions, almost you might say, in a way that Harriot's work didn't. To be quite frank, I hadn't realised myself, I'd heard of the chap before, but I hadn't realised that there were these maps in the historical record that he had produced a few months earlier in 1609. So, I've got to give the chap the credit, but I think Galileo still deserves the main credit for having launched the whole idea that you can use what you see through a telescope to sort of revolutionise your idea of what the universe is about. And that is very much in the spirit of what 2009 is about, because it's looking at how our understanding 400 years later is also continually being revolutionised by what we see when we look through the world's biggest telescopes. Okay, so here's as far as we got. It wasn't the world's biggest, but it was probably about the world's best when it was commissioned in the mid-1980s. And I had the privilege of going to La Palma to see the William Herschel telescope that we see here on, it was December of 1990 on a very wet and cloudy day. So basically what you're seeing here is all the clouds below the level of the observatory, but I'm afraid when I was there, the observatory was in the clouds, didn't get any chance to use it, but it was at least a chance to talk to some of the staff and to learn about how it's operated. And as I mentioned last week, this was the first telescope of this size where there wasn't an attempt to design it with what we call an equatorial mount. That means so that it would essentially rotate with the stars. Instead, its mounting is just what's called an altazimuth mount. That means it can go horizontally, it can swivel vertically, but the stars don't do that. The stars don't just go up and down, they go across the sky at a slant. So the computers have to control this telescope to take account of that. Relatively easy task, but you know, we've got to remember we were all using ZX Spectrums back then, so you know, still quite challenging in a way to ensure that the computers were up to the task and that the image would remain stable enough, looking at often a very small field of view, an arc second or so, so that you could do very detailed work. So the engineers were really proud of this, and when I was there, I was still a graduate student then. I was on a kind of winter school, lots of intensive lectures down at ground level, actually over in Tenerife. We spent a little time in La Palma, but we just got a weekend up at the observatory, and sadly it was completely clouded out the whole time. But they also told me a few interesting tales, like we saw the dome on the outside, And another feature of this dome was that it basically the whole thing rotated. It wasn't just that you had, well, you can maybe see this, as you walk along the walkway, then the bottom of the dome is sort of level with where your feet would be. In particular, therefore, there wasn't a solid wall with a rotating dome above it. The whole dome rotated. So I was told of instances where people would, you know, pop out of the dome to go to the bathroom and then come back and the door wasn't where they had left it, which was slightly disconcerting. But, you know, you get used to these things. And certainly, when I was graduate school head here, a few years ago, and I had to sign off on our graduate students going on research trips, you know, going to observe at the tops of mountains was among the most interesting risk assessments you always had to take, you know, because most of the time if we're just sitting in front of a computer, nothing very much can go wrong. But when you're 15,000 feet up a mountain and your brain's not working properly and there's all kinds of very heavy equipment around, then you've really got to keep your wits about you. So that's the William Herschel. And these days, to be honest, looks rather puny, but at the time was quite impressive. It's a 4.2-metre aperture telescope. So I think a good point to kind of kick off with tonight is just to look at where things currently stand. So there's the WHT there. There's a whole line of them. I forget what all the acronyms stand for, but many of them you've maybe heard of yourself before. Certainly the Keck telescopes have achieved a great deal of publicity in recent years. The VLT, standing for Very Large Telescopes, that's an array of four telescopes in the Southern Hemisphere. So we're going to look at some of these in a wee bit more detail over the next few minutes. So let's begin our kind of tour with the Keck telescopes. This is a pair, and in a subsequent week we'll talk a bit more about why it should be that you would want to build telescopes in this manner, you know, a pair of them together. It's really all to do with the same reason that essentially our brains can make rather more sense of the world and can judge the distances of things and can discern details in things by the fact that our brains combine the two images. It's in radio astronomy, this basic principle has been, you know, taken to a higher level for many years. It's called interferometry. And what you do is you combine radio signals arriving at two often very widely separated telescopes, and by combining the information together you can learn more than you would from each telescope on its own. So more on that in a subsequent week, but just in case you're kind of wondering, you know, why they built two, it wasn't a case of, you know, buy one get one free. It really was that the intention from the outset was to exploit the science more effectively by having two. They add up to more than the sum of their individual parts. Now the design of Keck is similar to the William Herschel telescope in one important respect, which is that, again, it's not an equatorial mount. It rotates horizontally, it swivels vertically. But there was another very big difference from WHT. The William Herschel had a single mirror 4.2 metres across. Keck was one of the first of a new generation of really large telescopes where the mirror consists of a series of segments. Okay, so you can see from this sort of aerial view that they're kind of hexagonal shaped, like a honeycomb, and those segments are lighter, easier to build, obviously easier to repair. If you've just, you know, got one damage, then you can take it out, put in a replacement, you don't have to replace the whole mirror. And pretty much all big telescopes are designed this way now. Here's just another kind of cutaway view of the Keck. As you can see, there's 36 of these mirror segments joined together. This is a Cassegrain design. Actually, there's several other focuses closely related to the Cassegrain design. One's called the Naismith. It's over at right angles. So the main point to take from this is what you want with a really big telescope is the ability for people to use it, sort of different groups of people to use it at the same time. Now obviously they can't be looking at two different things on either sides of the sky at the same time, but if you're looking at, say, a different galaxy, it might be advantageous to be able to study it with two different sorts of instruments at the same time. So what you're doing there is you're splitting the light beam so that some of the light goes down to the Cassegrain focus and some of the light goes across to this other focus where you could have a different kind of detector. Now a little bit later, we'll look specifically at what detectors were on board the Hubble telescope. So I won't say any more about detectors for the moment, But most modern observatories nowadays on the ground have very sophisticated detectors, essentially big, you know, digital cameras, if you like, which are an enormous improvement in themselves over what we had when I was younger. So aside from the improvements in the size of the telescopes, they're also much better just because their detectors are much better. And Keck is a real very good example of that. Being at the top of a mountain in Hawaii also helps. Keck is in Mauna Kea, which I've not been to this one. This is, if memory serves, I think it's about 18,000 feet. It's very high, much higher than La Palma. And there's a real cluster of major observatories there. In fact, this is just one of the newer parts of the Mauna Kea group. There's a number of smaller telescopes that have been there for, you know, more than 20 years. But what you see here is the twin Keck, sort of essentially about 10 metres in diameter, telescopes, which I guess is roughly about the size of this room from one side to the other, I would guess. And then this one here is called the Subaru Telescope. It's Japanese funded with also some funding from various US institutions. And it's more than 8 metres, the mirror. Again, it's in segments. And you see the Subaru, there's the dome, and there's the mirror looking at the way... Oops, I thought I had the big... Yeah, here we are. So looking at the way that they all sort of scale, there's this honeycomb shape. So obviously... The two together, their total collecting area is large, and that's, I'd meant to say this when we first looked at this slide, the purpose of the white circle that you see there is to give you a rough idea of what the effective area of Keck is, because you've got two mirrors. It performs rather like a single telescope with the larger mirror indicated by the white circle. But the interferometry effect that I mentioned brings even more. It brings a greater ability to be able to measure very fine detail in the image that you're looking at and the source that you're looking at. And as I said, I'll see more about that, actually a little more tonight, but mainly in a subsequent week.
Can I ask a question?
Sure, yeah.
Yes,
certainly. I mean, I've never been quite that high, but even the highest I've been, I think, is about... I say La Palma must be about 12,000, 13,000. And you do kind of have to almost train for it, you know, for a wee while in advance. Last summer I was at a workshop for 2 weeks in Aspen, and that wasn't at an observatory, but it's still at about, I think, 9,000 feet. And I found that quite tough as well, you know, because it's one thing going in a hill climb in Scotland. First of all, you're only going to be at 4,000 feet anyway. But you're just, you know, you're physically tired, but you're not having to solve equations and write programs and all that kind of stuff at the same time, you know? So the extra demands of doing intellectually difficult things at the same time as the physical effort of breathing, so it takes a lot of getting used to. And people who've been to Mauna Kea regularly tell me that even the most simple things, like, you know, you've got to press this button to switch something off. You know, they put a wee label on it or something, you know, just to make sure they don't press the wrong thing, because your brain just doesn't think straight at that kind of altitude. So once or twice when I have been going to the La Palma group in the Canaries, I've only been a handful of times, but, you know, quite often the cheapest way to go is on a package flight, you know, flight only for a package holiday company. And of course, sure, you'll wind up sitting beside someone and you know, say, oh, well, I'm going to work, I'm going to... go to the observatory, and of course people say, oh, that must be a great job, you know, you get to go to La Palma, and then you try and tell them, well, actually, you know, you're more than 10,000 feet above sea level, and you've got to stay up all night, you know. Mm-hmm. I suppose the people down at ground level probably stay up all night as well, so, but, you know, it's a good point, and I think already I'm probably at the stage where I'm starting to get not nearly as good at that sort of thing as I used to be. And one of our former students, who was an undergraduate here, is now a postgraduate in St Andrews, and I spoke to him just last week, and he was just on the point of going off to La Palma to do 5 nights solid observing. And I said, oh, drop me an email when you get back and let me know how you get on, because he wasn't sure if he would have the stamina. But yeah,
have any of the big telescopes be used for both visual and radio?
The I'm sorry, I've anticipated what you were going to say at the end. Can they be used for both?
Yes.
That's what I thought perhaps you were going to say. Not the telescopes themselves, but many of the sites have radio telescopes nearby. Again, I'll come to that in just a few minutes. That's another excellent question. Okay, so let's press on. I shouldn't get too bogged down in all these anecdotes, but tell you about the sites. This is the, actually this leads on to your question quite nicely. This is the Very Large Telescope Array in Chile. The observatory is called Paranal, and it's the Atacama Desert in Chile. So it's in the Andes, high altitude, extremely dry. They get, you know, more than 350 nights a year clear, typically. You know, essentially, you know, a night when there's cloud is a real rarity. And the amount of moisture in the air is very, very low indeed. I think Antarctica still qualifies as the driest place on Earth, which I always think is kind of strange. I think it's just because it's so cold that all the moisture is frozen out of the air. And it is very cold at the peak here. But the conditions are extremely favourable to doing observing. Having moisture in the air just makes the air shimmer a bit more. I'm sure we've probably all seen that. You know, if it's a kind of frosty night or a misty night, then sometimes you see a kind of halo of colours around the moon, and that's the light from the moon being bent, refracted by the water in the air. So that might look very nice, but you don't want that when you're trying to observe faraway things. So these are four telescopes, the real sort of jewel in the crown of the European Southern Observatory. And Britain joined the European Southern Observatory a number of years ago, having previously, you know, in a little bit of a mimicking or, you know, political stance in all things European, one might say, had sort of stood in the sidelines for decades thinking, oh, the French and Germans can't possibly do this as well as we can, so we'll collaborate with the Australians and the US instead. But actually, this, you know, is, if anything, is a very strong counterexample. You know, you might not have shared that view to begin with, but when this telescope was commissioned in 1999, it really made the UK astronomy community realise that we ought to be part of this, because it's four 8-metre class telescopes, and altogether, as you maybe saw from the slide back there, the collecting area of all four of them together is, you know, at the moment at least, basically the largest in the world. But more importantly, this idea of interferometry, of combining the light from all four telescopes, that exploits the fact that you're looking along different lines of sight. So just like, you know, using your left and right eye together, you get a better detailed view of the world. Similarly, that's been done with the VLT. And indeed, although you don't quite see it in this image, well, maybe you get a bit of a sense of it, the separation of the telescopes is more like about 100 metres. So it's not quite like saying you've got a 100-metre telescope, because you don't collect as much light as if you had a mirror 100 metres across. But your ability to determine small-scale features in an image, provided it's bright enough to see it in the first place, is almost as good as it would be if you had a 100-metre telescope. So that's the way that ground-based observations have gone. So here we are, and this again just gives you an idea of the scale. So all of that interferometry business is handled in this control room here, the VLT interferometer, because essentially what you've got to do is you've got to combine the light extremely carefully and extremely accurately. You've got to know exactly what light was hitting the telescope over here at precisely the same time light was hitting the telescope over here. Now, if you think what's involved in doing that, again, just to anticipate ideas that I'll explore in more detail in a subsequent week, we know that light goes very, very fast, 300,000 kilometres per second. And light's a wave, so what you're essentially having to record is what we call the phase of the light. That means, you know, is it at the top of the wave or the bottom of the wave, when the light from some distant star hits the two telescopes. So that means you've got to make your timing measurements roughly at the level of, well, how far would light travel? No, let me say it the other way around. How long would it take light to travel the 10 metres or so, which is, you know, the scale of the telescope? Or even if we're generous and say, how long would it take light to travel the 100 metres, which is the distance between the telescope? well, it's not very long. You know, light travels 300,000 kilometres a second. So it's going to travel 100 metres in about, you know, a 10 millionth of a second. So that's the timing accuracy you need to do this interferometry. And that's really why it's only become possible in the last few years. Now with radio, it's not so bad because the wavelength of radio waves is much longer. So you don't need to have such high precision in what bit of the wave you're looking at. If you think about it, you know, radio Clyde 261 metres. I forget what they are, the wavelengths of many of the other stations, they quote them in the frequency rather than the wavelength, but that's the one I remember from my youth. So that's the wavelength of radio waves, and therefore as long as you can measure the separation between your radio telescopes to about a metre, then that's less than 1% of the wavelength. If you wanted to measure the separation of these telescopes to less than 1% of a wavelength, it would have to be about a million millionth of a metre, which is a lot more challenging. So, the view you get from VLT is amazing. Very dry conditions, very dark conditions, and clear skies. And it's also in the southern hemisphere, which means you can see things that you can't see from the northern hemisphere. You can see the centre of our galaxy. You can see other galaxies which are at latitudes too low to be visible from the north. And the VLT site, so this to kind of try and link this in a bit more to Hubble again. Well, here's some of the figures. The humidity, 5 to 20%. You know, contrast that with, I don't know what a typical figure for here would be, but you know, quite often over 50%. Yeah, exactly, that sounds about right. I was trying to be conservative, but yeah, that's a bit more like it. And I mean, I've been to the odd place in Asia where the humidity is usually more like, you know, 90-95%. So it's very low. 100 mils per year is all the rainfall they get, and it never gets very warm, but the temperature is quite stable, which is good. The temperature gradient's a bad thing, because if the temperature changes too much over the night, then the mirrors will expand and contract, and that messes up your optics as well.
But it can be, but it's difficult to adjust things for that.
Well, actually, I'm glad you asked that, because I can just briefly mention, again, these are things which don't relate so much to Hubble, but they're very much at the forefront of modern telescope technology. If you look at Keck, for example, because the mirror consists of all these individual pieces, you can individually control them, and therefore you can adjust the shape of the mirror to reflect changes in the temperature, you know, to try and compensate for the fact that the individual elements are all expanding or contracting. That's what's called active optics. And another even more sophisticated version of that is adaptive optics, where what you try to do is not just account for changes in the telescope shape, but changes in the atmosphere, changes in the stability of the atmosphere, to try and effectively stop the stars from twinkling. And that's very sophisticated. That's basically what this thing is, which, so your question allows me to just briefly mention this. This is actually an artificial star called a laser guide star. So what they do is they fire a laser beam up, and if there's thin cloud up there, then basically the laser beam will illuminate that. And then you can image that, and of course what you should be seeing is just a little dot, but it's not, it's whizzing about, you know, twinkling, shimmering, and you can adjust the shape of the mirror to correct for all that. And if you do that, then of course what you'll also do is correct for the images of any stars as well. So that's adaptive optics.
Is there any significance in the layout of the four, to the extent that three seem to be in a row?
Yep.
As if the
bubbles
made a mistake for the fourth.
No, that's a good point as well. Not really. What was thought about was that what you want to have, if you want to do interferometry, is some telescopes which are quite nearby. Essentially, it goes like this. Do you mind if I delay that question? I mean, it's a great question, but there's a few slides coming up that I think will maybe help to answer it better. So just hold that thought. It's a very good one, but I'll make sure that when I talk about the related topic, that I sort of double back and specifically explain how it relates to the VLT. Okie doke. So, now this is a bit too small to read, but... Well, maybe you can just about make it out. But I just wanted to mention that the slide I showed before, which I've used in a number of presentations over the years, is now out of date, because there's now an even bigger telescope that's just been commissioned. The 10-meter kecks, okay, when you add them both together, you get an even bigger mirror. But in terms of the largest, you know, single telescope, then it's actually now in the Canaries, in La Palma. So the Observatorio del Roque de los Muchachos, which is where the William Herschel telescope was, that we began tonight with, is now the home of the world's biggest telescope, 10.4. Well, the world's biggest optical telescope, I should be careful, because there's radio telescopes are much bigger. But it's 10.4 metres, and we'll talk about that in a moment. But another one that's worth mentioning, because it's kind of the way that the future of telescopes is going, is called the Hobby-Eberle Telescope, and this will give me a chance to stop talking for a few minutes and let you listen instead to how this was described in the recent Sky at Night programme. So I've got a wee video clip of that, and some of you might have seen it. If you didn't, then it's quite interesting to see how the technology is developed.
It's still the third largest astronomical mirror in the world, but it was built at a fraction of the cost of a normal telescope of this size. And the reason is its mount.
The telescope was designed from the very beginning to have a structure containing the optics that was fixed at an angle, in this case, of 35 degrees.
So this mirror always stays at this angle?
It always stays at this angle. That was a cost saving. We saved probably 80% of the cost of making the same size telescope fully spherical.
You don't need this huge mount.
We don't need a huge mount. We don't need the motors, the engineering. The cost, of course, is that we only can ever observe objects that are in a ring 35 degrees off the vertical. That ring, because of the motion of the tracker, has a width which is about plus or minus 8 degrees. So over the course of a year, 70% of the sky passes through the ring.
How long can you observe a single object for?
That depends on where the telescope is pointing. If we're looking due south, it's about 45 minutes. If we're looking due north, it approaches 2 to 3 hours.
So the way the future of telescope building on the ground at least is going is that because they're heavy, because they're expensive, what you do is you don't worry so much about being able to steer them anywhere in the sky. You just wait until the sky has changed so that what you want to look at happens to appear in the line of sight. Now that's all very well if the things you're looking at, as most things up there are just the same from night to night, from week to week, from month to month, from year to year. But if you want to look at what we call transient objects, things like exploding stars, or even maybe something like a planet going around another star, but it's changing all the time what you would see, then this design of telescope is not so well suited. But it is impressively large and is only just behind the Canaries one and the Keck telescopes as the biggest in the world, 9.2 metres. So there, you see it there, HET, the Hobby-Eberle Telescope. This one's worth a mention as well. Looks almost a bit like a giant robot or something there, but this is the Large Binocular Telescope, which is, oh crikey, I meant to check this because I haven't been to this one. I think it's McDonald Observatory in Texas, but forgive me if I've got that one wrong. It's southern US anyway, and it's another example of where a big push has been made to try and exploit this interferometry effect by having more than one mirror on the same instrument. Another example of that is what are known as the Magellan telescopes. These are in Chile as well, not that far from the VLT. And there's another one in the pipeline called the Giant Magellan Telescope. This is just an artist impression, but it's going to be 30 to 35 metres across. And this is a proposal that's been driven forward by Caltech and the University of California and various other institutions in the US. And, well, it was originally known as the Californian Extremely Large Telescope, or KELT. And indeed, there was an interesting little game being played to come up, you know, with the cleverest and most impressive sounding acronym, because there was another project called OWL, which was the Overwhelmingly Large Telescope project. Makes you kind of wonder where it's all going to end. But just like the Hobby-Eberle, this one, for all it's very, very large, I mean, look at the size compared with the little chap down here, it's not very steerable because you don't want to be moving that much mirrored glass around. But that's where things are going from the ground. So, here's the Gran Telescopio in the Canarias. Let me just check. Have I got that one right? No. I'm sorry. I'd fail a test of, you know, spot the world's major telescopes. It's kind of hard to tell from the outside, of course, because it's just a big dome. This one is actually the South African Large Telescope, or SALT, which is in Sutherland, north of Cape Town. And I think the next one is the... Yeah, that's it. That's the... with the very good giveaway that you can see the ocean behind it, that's the one in the Canaries, the Gran Telescopio Canarias. And that's what it looks like in the inside. Anyway, so, quick tour of all these big telescopes. The one thing, of course, you'll take from all of this is that they're up at the tops of mountains, or they're at high altitude, or they're far away from light pollution from cities. And as you can see, this is a, you know, kind of famous image that was taken over a number of years, building up a view of what the Earth looks like from space. Well, you know, the Northern Hemisphere is pretty light polluted. It's hard to find places where there isn't substantial amounts of light pollution, especially in North America. But, you know, much of South Africa, much of the whole continent is clear, but especially Southern Africa, and certainly most of Western Australia. So, you know, there are good places around to get far away from streetlights. If you want a combination of remote and far away from streetlights, but also at high altitude, then that's a bit more challenging. But, you know, the Andes is one of our premier sites there. There's another advantage with putting telescopes in somewhere like the Andes. If we think again about the VLT site, Cerro Paranal, so the number of clear nights is typically about 350. Amount of water vapour, very low. And, well, if you look at Mauna Kea in Hawaii, there's the Keck, there's the Subaru, various others that have been built on similar timescales. That one's called the James Clerk Maxwell Telescope. This one's Gemini North. There's the whole bunch. And here's the WHT that we saw before. Well, one of the reasons why you want to put these at high altitude is just simply so that you can see more. In other words, it's not just a case of the skies are clearer, but also that more radiation actually gets through than at the ground. The world's best observatories are generally at high altitude for both of those reasons. So first of all, you are not so badly affected by what's called absorption, which is the effect that the atmosphere absorbs a lot of radiation, which is very useful for us because it protects us from harmful radiation like X-rays and gamma rays and even some ultraviolet. But also, it's generally clearer because you're at an altitude where most of the cloud winds up below you. And that's because of the creation of what's called an inversion layer. So let's talk a bit more about that. You see examples of inversion layers in some quite famous places around the world. One of the reasons why San Francisco winds up getting fogged in so much is because of the mixing together of warm air from the south and also colder air from the ocean and from Northern California. So you wind up with these fog banks on the bridge a lot. And the same kind of, I thought I had another slide, but I guess I don't. The same phenomenon is seen at many of the world's observatories. Essentially, if you put the telescope at the top of a mountain, that's already a very good start. But if you put it at the top of a mountain close to an ocean, then what's likely to happen is that a cloud bank will form below the top of the mountain, just because of the way, that the temperature balance or imbalance between the land and the sea creates the right conditions to have this bank of cloud, you know, very analogous to why you get this bank of fog in the Golden Gate bridge in the Bay Area. So these inversion layers can be very useful because it means that your telescope's above that and therefore it should have much clearer air above it again. So what are you going to see? Well, this is what we call the electromagnetic spectrum. It goes all the way from X-rays, and indeed gamma rays are beyond that even, to radio. And what this graph shows up the vertical is what fraction of the energy that comes to us from space actually reaches the height as shown in the graph. So, well, it's completely opaque to x-rays, and that's very good news for us. We can generate our own x-rays if you go to a hospital and get one, but you don't want to be getting bombarded by x-rays from the sun, for example, on a regular basis. Otherwise, it would be seriously harmful. As you go to shorter wavelengths, even ultraviolet, extreme ultraviolet radiation doesn't penetrate. Some ultraviolet does, not very much, but enough that it gives us concern about getting sunburn. As you go to the visible, a nanometer is 1/1,000,000,000 of a meter. So 100 nanometers is 10 millionths of a meter. So these are real very, very small wavelengths of light. Then the colours of the rainbow form what we call the visible part of the electromagnetic spectrum, or often known as the optical window. And that radiation does get all the way down to the ground, at least most of the time in Scotland. As you go on into the infrared, then some of the radiation gets down to the ground. Infrared is sort of like heat radiation, really. But a lot of that heat can be absorbed by water, H2O. So that's why getting to a part of the atmosphere where it's very dry and you're above most of the water means that the water above the telescope won't absorb the infrared radiation. And as you go on up to radio wavelengths, much longer wavelengths, like, you know, the 261 meters that I mentioned, actually these are slightly shorter than that, and indeed we also talk about the microwave part of the spectrum, then again the atmosphere is fairly transparent. As you go to longer radio wavelengths, then part of the Earth's atmosphere that we call the ionosphere becomes reflective. Now you might be aware of that, you know, sometimes at night you can pick up radio signals from very far away because they're actually bouncing off the ionosphere. But in the same way, if you've got radio signals coming in from an object out in space, then it's just going to bounce off the ionosphere and go straight back out again. So that's not very good either. So our opportunities are actually kind of limited. We can do well in the visible. We can see some infrared, but only if it doesn't get absorbed by water. So you want to be at high altitude so that that's not so much of a problem. And we can see some parts of the radio. Ah yes, I did have this slide. It's slightly in the wrong order from what I'd planned. Be a bit wordy this one, but just to recap the points I was making, that what happens if you're in a place with the right atmospheric conditions is that you can get a cloud bank, say at an altitude of about 2 kilometres, and then actually above that it gets a bit warmer for a bit, and then the temperature drops again, and that inversion layer, where the temperature increases with height, will mean that clouds will form at the base of the inversion layer, generally leaving clear air above. And indeed, if you're on a plane, often they'll do that as well. They'll go up to a higher altitude where there's clearer air, and you look down and you see this, you know, solid wall of cloud below you. It's the same idea. So why bother about the atmosphere? Well, okay, there's the issue of absorption, that you don't want the radiation you're trying to detect to be absorbed. But the other thing the atmosphere will do will scatter radiation. As the light comes in, it's going to bounce off the molecules, and that means that the image you'll get will be less sharp. So what you see here is, on the left-hand side, a series of images showing in the central box, that's just where it's nicely focused, and then in the left and right panels either side, it's where you're at a focal length that's inside the true focal length, or in the other case, outside. So in other words, if you've all done this, even if it's not with an astronomical telescope, if you've looked through a telescope, you adjust the focus, you get it nicely in focus, and then you can change the focus either to go even further out of focus, or bring it back through focus and move the lens closer to you. In both cases, you'll have a distorted image. And on the right-hand side, I guess the thing to note is that for the first view, it doesn't really look that bad. So what you're looking at in A, B, C, and D is just different amounts of scattering in the atmosphere. And D is where the scattering is comparable to what you would kind of probably get, you know, at the ground, whereas A, B, and C are at higher altitudes. And for D, what you can see basically is that it really does begin to have a noticeable effect on even something like Saturn. The top image is where there's no scattering at all. This is a simulation, I hasten to add. Okay, so what's been done is an image of Saturn, actually I think it was taken with HST, has been sort of processed to simulate the effects of the scattering in the atmosphere at different heights. And when you're down at the ground, it's a bit blurry. So to recap, the reasons why a space telescope's a good idea is, one, you can see types of light that don't normally get seen at the ground. But secondly, the light that does get through doesn't get scattered the way that light with an ordinary telescope would, so you should get
also get a much sharper image with ultraviolet because of your more focused diffraction limit.
Yeah, I'm going to come to diffraction limit. Let's not jump too far ahead, but that's certainly true. But it's not that big an effect. And the much bigger effect is just the improvement by the not shimmering. To give you an example, since you've asked the question, it's perfectly fine to cover it now. Like, say you take some of the ultraviolet filters which are on HST, their wavelength is maybe a factor of 2 shorter than the visible filters. So therefore, on the basis you've just said, you might expect then that for the telescope apertures the same, that you should get a sharper image. However, what the problem is that the blurring that you would get with the atmosphere could be a factor of 10 or 100 times. So most of the gain with HST is not really going to ultraviolet, it's just getting above the atmosphere. But the ultraviolet helps a bit as well. Yep. Perfect timing. So here's the slide. So we had mentioned there of diffraction, so let me see what that's all about. And this also links us into some of the ideas about interference, which I'll pick up again in a subsequent lecture, interference and interferometry. So, light from a distant object is so far away that we think of the light beams as spreading out like ripples in a pond, circles, the stars shining in all directions. But by the time the ripples reach us, essentially they're just like straight lines, they're like planes. In fact, physicists talk about these as plane waves. And if, you know, you do this in a pond, throw a stone into the pond, you'll see the ripple expand, and at first it's very clear that it's a circle, but as the circle gets bigger and bigger, if you just look at a small part of it, then it just kind of basically looks like a straight line. Okay? So that's what the telescope is seeing. It's seeing part of the spherical wave of light that's spreading out from the star, but the star's so far away that the telescope really just sees what we call a plane wave, just like a line. Now, if you've got two stars close together, then what will happen is that when that plane wave interacts with the telescope aperture, it's a little bit like what happens when a wave on the ocean comes to a gap in a harbour wall. The wave will pass into the harbour, but it will be disrupted in the process, and it will undergo what we call diffraction. It will spread out in a different way because it's been constrained to pass through the gap in the wall. In the same way, the light from this distant star is being constrained as it passes through the telescope aperture, and that will produce a very weird looking pattern of brightness. The brightness won't be uniform anymore. It will produce this pattern here. It's got a specific mathematical form, and all of this work was first developed by a number of scientists in the 19th century and early 20th century, so we understand very well what the shape of that pattern should be. And if you look at it head on, a point-like star, I mean, I've drawn it with the traditional 5 points, but that's just a cartoon. The real star that you're looking at is so far away that it's just effectively one point of light. That light spreads out in all directions, and when the wavefronts of the light hit the telescope, what it will produce is a series of concentric rings. Okay? Now, the problem is, if you want to look at two very nearby things, then the light from the point-like stars is going to be smeared out by these rings, so much so that the rings will actually overlap with each other. So, by building a space telescope, we can overcome the fact that the atmosphere causes the pattern of light to shimmer, but what we can't overcome is this diffraction effect which happens when the light is constrained to pass through a telescope of a certain size. Now, how bad is it? Well, a criterion was developed by Lord Rayleigh, a famous physicist from around that time, where he said the following. Let's just have a look at the single pattern first. You can see the single pattern's got a big spike in the middle, where most of the light is. I think it's 87% in the standards of mathematical model of this. And then there's lots of little secondary bumps around. So this is like a cross-section through it. And if we look at it in 2D, it's a series of rings. So what we are thinking of is saying, right, let's suppose we've got two stars side by side. The rings are going to overlap. How will we be able to tell that it's really two stars? Well, Lord Rayleigh said, you could kind of begin to tell that they're two stars if the peak of the first one, the one on the left, coincided with the first minimum of the one on the right. So if you look again just at the pattern on its own, it peaks in the middle, it drops to a minimum, and then it rises again. So he was saying if the two peaks are any closer together than having the peak of the one on the right level with the minimum of the one on the left, then they're simply too close together to be observed. And that's kind of what's shown here. What you'll get in that case is you'll get a little bit of a dip in the middle, but not really very much. So you'll hardly know that you're looking at two objects at all. And Lord Rayleigh didn't just propose this as a kind of rule of thumb. He worked out what the criterion was for such a situation. Now this is, there's very few formulae I'm going to throw at you in this course, but this one's maybe worth including. It's quite a simple one anyway. Theta is the angular size that you can resolve, that you can pick out details for. So you want theta to be really small. Think of it like on your computer screen, the more pixels there are, then the better resolution you can get in your screen. Or the more pixels on your digital camera there are, the better photographs you can get when you zoom in on them. It's the same idea. So theta is about 1 times the wavelength of the light divided by d, which was the size of the telescope. So now to come back to the question we had about ultraviolet. Ultraviolet's got shorter wavelength than visible light. So if the size of the telescope's the same, then it ought to be able to pick out smaller details for ultraviolet light than it would for visible light. And this formula is how you work that out. So the goal of any telescope is to be what you call diffraction limited. And that means it's not affected by scattering or absorption. It's only limiting capability. The only thing limiting its capability is this effect. If you've got two nearby light sources, then their patterns will overlap. There's not really anything you can do about that because it's fundamental physics that determines that. But at least if that's the limiting effect on your telescope, then it's still pretty good. Because if you think about it, remember I said when we were talking about wavelengths that a nanometer is a billionth of a meter. Now, the formula that we had there, this is in a different unit of angle measure called radians. A number of you might have heard of that. But if you kind of do the conversion in your head, not that I recommend it, but if you do, then the kind of wavelengths we're talking about here, with a telescope of the size of the Hubble, then you can pick out features which are less than an arc second across, about 0.1 arc seconds. Now an arc second is 1/3600th of a degree, or about an 1/1800th of the width of the full moon. So what we're saying is if you look at the full moon at night, and then, well, in fact, a good rule of thumb, quite literally, if you hold your thumb up at arm's length, it just about covers the moon, maybe even covers it a couple of times, depends how long your arm is and how big your thumb is, but it's a good rough guide. The features that Hubble could see, or it was designed to see, were about 1/20,000th of that width. Really, really fine. Whereas, from the ground, the effects that we've been discussing of all the blurring will mean that the resolution isn't diffraction limited, it's actually just limited by the twinkling of the sky. And it's more like a resolution of 10 arc seconds, 100 times worse from just a small telescope of similar size. Robert? It's, as indicated here, it's what we call the aperture size, so it's across the way. So the telescope can be longer.
Objective lens or mirror?
Yeah, basically, yeah. I mean, it's slightly different because, of course, we're talking here now about telescopes like we saw, which are hexagonal in shape and so on. So the simple formula that Lord Rayleigh derived was for a spherical, and rather a circular aperture. But, you know, that's why I was quite careful to say that the constant's about 1. The 1.22 is what you get if it's an exactly perfectly circular aperture. It's not exactly 1.22 if it's a hexagonal, but it's close enough. So lambda over d is your kind of rule of thumb. That so, as I say, apologies if that's more math than you were expecting in this course, but it's just to let you see that the goal here is to have a telescope where the atmosphere isn't limiting what you can do. It's just the fundamental property of what light does when it hits an aperture, when it's constrained to pass through the structure of the telescope. That's diffraction limited. So, the atmosphere, as I said, is a problem. A lot of the radiation that we would like to see from space, we simply can't because the atmosphere absorbs it. So, we can see in the optical, we can see a little bit in the infrared, we can see in the radio. But astronomical objects emit radiation in all these other bits as well. X-rays, gamma rays that aren't even on here, ultraviolet, submillimeter and so on. So, how do we get around that? We put a telescope in space. And, well, let me see how we're doing. Yeah, actually, it's nearly 8:30, so that's maybe quite a good point at which to break off. So that's me kind of done with reviewing ground-based telescopes, and then we'll just have a wee short break, maybe start again about 2:45. So that clock's useless, but I make it 8:30. So if we start again about 2:45, and then we'll look at Hubble, how it was designed, and the reasons why we wanted a space telescope. Okay, thank you.